I want to welcome you to this session of the Sunstone Symposium. The topic is Leadership and the Ethics of Prophecy. Responding to Dr. Edwards' paper is Margaret Batten, who teaches philosophy at the University of Utah. Her field is bioethics. She's edited and written books about death and dying, especially interested in euthanasia and suicide. Paul Edwards, I first met it when I was at Graceland College for 4 years. This was the first class that I dropped. So I'm interested to hear him speak about ethics because that was the class that I dropped, a class on ethics. After considering my academic load for the semester and talking to my academic advisor who thought over his colleague in philosophy, we both decided that it would be wise if I was to terminate my exposure to the ethics of Paul Edwards for this semester. Paul is currently the president of the Temple School at the RLDS Auditorium in Independence, Missouri. He's the president of the High Priest Quorum and also the pastor of the Walnut Gardens Congregation. He's the author of the recently published book Preface to Faith by Signature Books. In a religious tradition, the reorganized Latter-day Saint tradition, which is unfortunately often regarded faith and doubt as opposites, Dr. Edwards, I think, has stood out as someone who's always encouraged us to have an inquiring faith and to continue to struggle and pursue the truth wherever it leads us. Speaking on leadership and the ethics of prophecy, Dr. Paul Edwards.
Everybody here? May move to the other room? It's interesting how students remember things. I remember Larry leaving my class. I didn't remember that it was his decision. I'm not sure if this paper is legitimate, for I claim no prophetic posture and the same lack probably no knowledge of ethics. I have taught the latter for years, but I understand that those who cannot do often teach. And my familiarity with the former is simply the reading of the Doctrine and Covenants and other adult comic books. But granting such limitations, let me begin my comments with a parable. In the early 1950s, my friends and neighbors sent me to Korea to contain communism. Shortly after my arrival there, I developed a terrible toothache. Soon, pain, the great motivator for human activity, led me to leave the peace and security of the front line for what was laughingly called Division Rear. And from there to the remnant of man's inhumanity to man, identified as a field dentist. After a fleeting examination, the dentist pointed to a chair with an attached foot treadle, very much like an old sewing machine. The treadle was connected by direct drive to a drill. He commanded, with all the authority of an officer talking to a peon, pedal. Thus I found myself in the position of having to generate the energy for my own salvation. In the full knowledge that to do so would have become increasingly painful. This was a matter of commitment. But more than that, it was a matter of participation in the process of my necessity, both because of and despite the discomfort. This was not observation. It was not waiting for results. I was called upon to act ethically in my commitment. The role of leadership within the Mormon community is vastly interrelated and thus often confused with management. This much is obvious, more to the outsider than to the participant, and has been the subject of comment by no less an insider than Hugh Nibley. "Leaders are movers and shakers," he writes, "original, inventive, unpredictable, imaginative, full of surprises that discomfort the enemy in war and the main office in peace. For the managers are safe, conservative, predictable, conforming organizational men, and team players dedicated to the establishment," close quote. An even more pronounced distinction can be made, however, between leader and prophet, though it is often the case that they sometimes share the same voice. The ethics of leadership relates to the use and misuse of a position where one is called to lead, whereas the ethics of prophecy relates to the divine fulfillment within the act or the statement seen as prophetic. The leader, much like the field dentist, provides means and abilities to lead those who would follow. The prophet assumes more the role of the participant patient, determinedly pursuing understanding, accepting involvement, and seeking a sense of transcendence in the immediate, even at the cost of great risk and pain. The dentist takes little risk. She is involved in the immediate, making few decisions in terms of pain value orientation. Her mission is clear, her evaluation simple. The prophet, however, succeeds or fails in both the process and the outcome, knowing through involvement that honest expression is impossible without reaffirming the continual meaning of the activity, without putting past and present into new light, without sensing fulfillment. Prophecy is the finite expression of an inner understanding which in its true insightfulness illuminates our history and confronts our anxieties. It brings past understanding and present confusion into a new understanding and provides disclosure on the presence of God. It should not be confused with policy, for it is a sense of the perennial as well as the limited, and is only ethical when it speaks of God's transcendence in the immanence by those living imminently in transcendence. He who speaks in the words, the mood, and the expectation of prophecy, and does not speak from transcendent participation, violates the role of leader and the ethics of the prophet. There is a necessary paradox resident in any expression of religious experience. Language is designed to express information about a subject which is perennial, yet we must try to be meaningful in a particular time and a particular space. Words relate to the religious person's penetrating movement from one position of conversion to another. Such communication is poetic, making precise, finite, and literal language impossible. But it does not relieve us from the fact that such an experience must be communicated, or the prophetic leader fails. The language of prophecy must somehow go beyond what Karl Barth describes, quote, as the establishment and transmission of the results already achieved, close quote, where we simply express the same spiritual understandings over and over again, as if from the beginning. For what is commanded by God is commanded anew, quoting Barth here, in every moment for that moment, through the faithfulness of the will, binding all the moments together, and giving abiding direction amidst the novelties of changing days, close quote. In religious language, God's transcendence keeps him apart from the common experience, for the language itself requires us to speak of God in the present tense. This dualism concerning God creates a special problem for the prophet. It calls her to walk the fine line between reason and imagination. We tend to see reason, the arbitrator of life, and to assign imagination to the role of the inner being. Thus, we are likely to regard imagination as a kind of fantasy, failing to note that imagination is a very different thing from mythology. The latter is the use of personal images in objective knowledge. But the former, that is imagination, is the employment of unlimitedness in relationship and is not akin to objective as much as it is subjective knowledge. To walk this line, the prophetic sight requires the freedom of skepticism. Real skepticism, of course, does not exist within primitive societies. It is a product of our intellectual and spiritual sophistication. Before we had the insight and the courage to doubt what appeared to be true, we were subject to every unexplained or overexplained phenomena. The simple flexing of nature in its natural state gave us centuries of unconquered anxieties. In effect, we lacked the ability, the cultural experience, the education, the knowledge to rise above our environment and find meaning in chaos and in confusion. Such pre-skeptical persons lived in the non-rational eternity of a perennial present, relying on instinct and living as creatures of response rather than analogy. Their tie was with the past and was nostalgic rather than epistemological. Reluctant to live in other than their reoccurring animal dreams, they looked for inspiration from the stones, and being uninhibited by past or by future, relied on the shortness of the day for hope. And in doing so, were set aside from the most fundamental and supreme freedom, the freedom of knowing. Living epistemologically, if apprehensively, in the future as well as in the past, then, the questing prophet must rely on skeptical freedom, faith, and personal confidence to both question and assimilate inspiration. Here, living amidst the chronic civil war of reason and response, she must see the significant ground between the passion of egotism and the dawning spirituality. The message of Jesus Christ called persons from superstition and demonic vagueness, as well as from the dominance of unquestioned law. Young Joseph Smith's response to the denominations that knew too much was part of a new assumption for persons, an assumption that the universal purpose is reflected in order and assurance, but that human understanding goes beyond order to participation. These principles serve as controls on the arbitrariness of decisions, the injustice of laws, the use of authority that is only heritage, and on beliefs turned into creeds. The ethical prophet is not concerned primarily with the solving of the problems generated from institutions or traditions, nor, I might add, administrative appointments. Rather, he seeks to fashion a new synthesis which draws the whole from that which is, and from that which is not yet, and from that which of necessity must be. This is the perilous occupation of the prophet. It will leave many awaiting instruction, some seeking new signs of leadership, and many frustrated and confused over the indirectness. But it seems to me that the prophet can never be inside an institution in the manner in which a leader or a manager must be. For the prophet is by nature an outsider, a cosmic outsider, as I have called him. And any institution that tries to make him other than that denies the message and his gifts. The prophet standing outside the mainstream of human thought will live in the discrepancy between achievement and waste, between a life of quiet desperation and one of vitality. His despair arises from his vision, for he is aware of the alarming mediocrity that encompasses his world and his deep concern at being so much a part of it. In his immense confusion, he knows he sees too deep and too much, and yet it is he who the blind, sodden beast has dragged down into mankind. Such a person sees the unexpected and lives in bewilderment before the awesome mystery of listening. Being alien to the rational expectations and living in the dangerous but productive land of the assumed, She walks the tightrope between knowing and feeling. Such a person encompasses rather than seeks knowledge of God. So isolated, the prophet finds her home only in the shadows of the reality. Here she may well mimic the confused and distorted versions of the world, but living on the fringe of use-directed images, she discovers what she is thinking and feeling is not practical. It has no usefulness because it is so universal. Thus, she continually deals with a personal confrontation between what she knows to be meaningful and what her environment assumes to be worthwhile. Living in the confrontation of the immediate and the perennial, this outsider discovers that he cannot accept life as it is, that he cannot consider his own existence beyond that of another, nor his necessary inheritance in the structure of the world. He realizes that his travels through the hell of his own inner being raise questions about his own self-worth. He understands that he is sick in a civilization that does not yet know of its own sickness. And this concern burns within because it cannot be understood without. Denied the opportunity to speak about the sense of meaning that stirs restlessly upon his soul, the prophetic utterance, when made, will burst upon the scene like water from an overfilled balloon, and will come at those critical moments when the community, through its own struggles and despair, arrive at a point where the prophet and his people touch. The rest of the time, this person is unexpressed, his comments serving as bonbons and chocolate eclairs of the spirit, with persons busy eating the menu when they are desperately in need of a meal. The prophets find themselves without a pattern of life other than the compulsion to live at the very edge of experience, trembling in risk and secure only in belief. For when the prophet reemerges to communicate, he must be obviously different. He must be significantly changed by his experience. If not, persons will question his message and will say things like, "It's just Paul acting strange again." The frailty of his personal integrity becomes so obvious. His danger goes beyond what humans have gone. It is the realization that too much space smothers us even more than not enough space, and that the babble of voices, and that from the babble of voices, a mind must somehow mediate the ethical balance between management and cosmic madness. Such madness I have described as the image of immensity. I have borrowed this term from Blanchard to suggest that in order to understand the flow of the prophetic image, we need not wait for the phenomena always to be stabilized. The immensity is not an object, but rather a phenomenology of imagining. The events, the objects, the words of our expression are the byproduct of this existential experience, not the result of them. When we speak of the immensity of prophecy, we refer to that deep involvement that opens us to the otherness that is there to be experienced. Instead of losing oneself in the descriptions, we feel the presence of the essential. Here, quote, "The poet continues this love duet between dreamer and the world, making people and the world into two wedded creatures that are paradoxically united in the dialogues of their own solitude." Close quote. It is in this resonance that we experience prophecy. It is in the reverberations that we extend it so that it becomes our own. It possesses us by the impact of our acceptance and the power of its reaffirmation in us. Being deafened by the reverberations of what we have said, we can no longer hear it or consider it as objective. Seeing the prophet then as cosmic outsider, I suggest that he or she is not in the real sense a leader, but is at best a navigator. And when she generates responses, she does so with every possibility of an ethical presentation. Let me conclude then Don't get excited. I've got several pages. Let me conclude then by suggesting that these cosmic expressions are very, very frail. Part of our dilemma is that within Mormonism, that is all Mormonism, we have not decided on our response to Joseph Smith. Do we do what he said or what he did? By did, I mean operate as if the almost daily workings of the church were a matter of prophetic response. From my perspective, it seems that the LDS had been more inclined to do what he said, and the RLDS to do what he did. But neither, honestly, have come to grips with this, still holding on to what he said, that is, the expression of his religious and organizational attitudes, and defending that against the concepts expressed in his action to seek new guidance and new light as a management tool. The latter puts the church on the cutting edge and yet at the same time makes it very insecure and very vulnerable. To assume new guidance on each and every subject may well express the concept of doing what Joseph did, but we cannot free ourselves to do that. Until we restrict our current ideas to the immediate and free them from being permanent and untouchable things, we will not see change in the expressions of God's will. Caught between the timelessness of our affirmations and the immediacy of power in behavior, we have not dealt with the conflict or seen the limitations. This conflict is the cause of many of our dispersions, I believe, dispersions which grow like wild asparagus. They pay tribute to a return to the truths of Joseph, but are offended by those institutions which respond to methods suggested by these truths. While we understand that freedom imposes free will, what is not so evident is that free will can only operate when there is an understanding of what is real. The freedom of our prophetic voice is always limited because it does not emerge from such understanding of reality. The outsider, the cosmic prophet, has such a sense, though he recognizes that it may not reflect a popular view of reality. He stands in opposition to our obsession with fragments which have grave consequences, not the least of these consequences being fanaticism. Fanaticism, I think, has been beautifully defined as redoubling one's effort after one's aim has been forgotten. The courage of assertion is that the prophet is free. It is impossible to jump when you are falling, I might suggest. Limp assertions about the ground upon which one stands is defeating, and yet any expression without it is unethical. The goal of the body of Christ lies in individual lives measured within the community. Thus, when prophecy emerges from institutional goals rather than from human freedom, it fails. The meandering of positions, of changes, of new interpretations of institutional problems is a response that lies outside understanding. Those limited to their own environment or to immediacy make the mistake of seeing every sorrow as the pride of persons, every failure the inadequacies of community. Such a view epitomizes the empathetic fallacy, the mistake of believing that human beings lack feelings as do inanimate objects or abstractions. We must be constantly reminded that whatever we imagine in order to solve our problem or to relieve our institutional confusions do not become the real world, and that the powerful understanding of God is muted when heard only in institutional and organizational expectations. Much of our spiritual experience is for assurance that God is, with little comprehension of being with God. Perhaps it is because we speak words as if words express the real meanings. To call contemporary prophets to the poetry of the Psalms may be far too much, but to call them to rise above the assumption that their language communicates the source of their commitment is only to ask them to speak as prophets. The ethical prophet speaks to the wholeness of the people in such a way that we grasp the truth that the beauty of the world and the mystery of evil are all bound together, not accidentally, but by reason of this truth, that the universe exhibits a creativity with infinite freedom and with infinite possibilities. The prophetic response emerges from the milieu of the community. The people seek justification for the meaning of lives, not only a meaning that lies in some future life, even though this certainly helps on occasion, but some sense that their daily bouts with pain and loss of dignity are not in vain. The manager may well define this problem. The leader may address immediate concerns and direct people through them. But the prophet speaks to the meaning of life both in the midst of chaos and in the midst of peace. This wisdom is neither deliberately sought nor contrived, and is valid in that way that poetic justice becomes valid over revenge. It is the evidence of the larger understanding that accomplishes the immediate aim. A wisdom which in moments of honesty draw us up to the conscious experience of a God as present. It calls one to smell, to smells and tastes from the darkest corners of oneself, and as a renewed whole to a reality which regenerates and requires persons to start life over and over again. Our prophetic view is limited when we assume the conflict between prophet and king can be resolved, any more than that between leader and manager, by anything else than freedom from expectation. For the prophet seeks not peace, nor security, nor growth, nor acceptance at the cost of truth. The leader often compromises for peace and the king for victory. The institutional pronouncements of behavior and the rules reaffirming via organizational rituals limit our ability to find the truth. Within Mormonism, there have been so many years of limited inquiries, so many abdications of feelings and responsibilities, so many professional rituals developed, that the power of prophecy is lost among necessities. Nowhere in the message of Jesus do we find instructions to submit ourselves to solemn ceremonies, to be obedient to the mysterious antics or the mumblings of prescribed fashion. It is this very concept that we find Jesus nailed to the cross to defend. And yet it is constantly reestablished under the guise of prophecy in his name and authority. This is not an argument against institutional loyalty. Organizations need leaders, I'm told, even managers. But the authority of persons with God is beyond these roles, and in the final analysis must control them. The temptation to take refuge in the institution emerges from reflection and from security. But prophets are never out of danger. Security dims awareness and limits the resources of involvement. To be a prophetic voice is to project the wrath of understanding and the cost of meaning. For faith is not a divine protection against destruction. The prophetic voice must surely be aware that to lead persons to God is to lead them to risk that unceasingly awaits them. As well, Mormonism has a tendency to assume prophecy follows acceptance. The prophetic utterance in its usual state will be contrary or ahead of or too basic for the contemporary fashions of ideas. Thus it compels the prophet to live beyond the immediate. It was C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters, you will remember, who has the devil initiate his apprentice by saying, quote, "The use of fashion in thought is to distract the attention of men from their real dangers." The idea, he explains, is to have all the people running around with fire extinguishers when there is a flood. The greatest triumph, however, is to elevate the horror of the same old thing into a philosophy, so that nonsense in the intellect may reinforce corruption in the will. Close quote. Mormonism also restricts the power of prophecy when it operates under the assumption that the institutional church has no power. This encourages us to avoid responsibility for what we are doing. Such freedom from responsibility is a violation of our giftedness and our agency. God works in the organization of that much we are assumed. But he does not manage it or lead it. We do. Our failure to take responsibility and to act accordingly is a byproduct of our acceptance of prophecy as cosmic policymaking or personnel selection. This non-participation through irresponsibility extends to our unwillingness to claim the power of consent. As members, we are the final judges of the ultimacy of prophecy. If we do not deal honestly with that power, or allow ourselves to be more moved by the media than the message, or if we find ourselves confusing organizational loyalty with prophetic reaffirmation, and so without open evaluations of messages we accept, then we fail God. I find the prophetic in the homesick person, not those without a home, not those who have not found a place to go, and not those who have no identity, but those desperately grasping to get there. It seems to me that the prophet speaks to us most ethically when he tells us of the awesomeness of that journey. Thank you.
Thank you. Some papers are so interesting and so important that you really need to hear them twice. And so what I'd like to do here is to tell you what I think Paul Edwards has said. Now, he has not had a chance to hear these comments or to read them, and I have some fear that he will be horrified, especially when he sees the conclusions to which I think what he has said leads. So I begin my remarks with the warning that at any point we may go astray. You might want to raise your hand when you think I'm off the off the target. Right. That there is one prior note, and that is to this is just in order to avoid confusion. The term prophecy is used in at least three different senses in ordinary discourse. It's very easy to have in mind the wrong one, and I think there is a special one being used here. In the first sense, and this is most characteristic of non-Mormon religious discourse, prophecy means foretelling future events, right? That's the sense associated with Old Testament prophets and is widely used in the Protestant, Catholic, and other non-Mormon and non-RLDS groups. Now, there are two other senses, though, that are, I think, more common in, I guess, both forms of LDS churches. In one of them, prophecy is used to refer to the articulations of the prophet, that is, of the spiritual leader and head of the church, or sometimes the articulations of any church official. But there's a third sense, and I think this is the sense that Mr. Edwards is using here, and that is a prophecy describes expressions based on personal religious experience. Now, they need not foretell the future. They may be about a variety of things. You've given us some account of what they do. But the essential point is that they are personal and born of experience. Okay? I think it's this third sense that is used primarily throughout this discussion, and that's what we will be referring to here.
I don't think simply disambiguating these senses will get rid of the problem, however. I actually think that the problem Mr. Edwards is focusing on here is a very interesting and complex and serious problem, and I'd like to try to show you what it is. Mr. Edwards' central concern is with the ethical problems confronting the prophet in the third of these senses, that is, the person who seeks to articulate and communicate his or her personal religious experience, not including necessarily any predictions of the future. Now, he does identify 11 conditions the prophet in this third sense, must meet in order that his or her prophecy be morally clean. Right? That is, there are 11 conditions embedded in the text of your paper that must be satisfied. So let me try to enumerate them. One, the prophet must be honest and accurate in conveying the experience. Two, the prophecy must be based on real experience, not invented. Three, the prophet must employ imagination and not just reason. Four, the prophet must make use of skepticism and be ready to challenge the truth of the experience at every point. And this is crucial, Edwards said, if the prophecy is not merely to be the record of this wonderful phrase, animal drama, that is the superstitious, knee-jerk, reactive religious belief characteristic of primitive societies, and perhaps of some others as well. That is, prophecy, this kind of experience must always be subjected to critique, however loyal that critique is. Five,
the prophet mustn't know too much or think that he or she does. Six, the prophecy must not be arbitrary. Seven, the prophet must not rely solely on heritage. Eight, the prophet must not let belief rigidify into creed. Nine, the prophecy must not be translated into what he calls professional ritual. 10, the prophecy must not be contrived. And 11, the prophet must not try to make the prophecy practical, that is, not try to conform it to the world. There may be other conditions, but I think these are the 11 that are most important in assuring that the prophecy is not used in an unethical way. Now, what's the problem? The problem arises for the person who, and this is the person who is gifted with prophecy in this sense, who also occupies a leadership position within an institutional church. Presumably, this person's suitability for leadership and his or her interest in and commitment to it are born of this underlying profound religious experience. But he or she cannot make use of this in an institutional setting without doing violence to it, and hence without misusing and abusing his or her position. That's the problem. Why does it arise? It arises because the skills the person requires in his or her position as church leader are essentially managerial. The task is to maintain order, to improve services, to promote the growth of the church itself, and to lead its members to God. To do this, the person appeals to the prophetic insight, that is, the personal religious experience which he or she has had. But in appealing to it, the huge risk is distortion, since this experience is intrinsically so difficult to convey. People are easy to persuade, and the church leader sees that persuasion can bring them to believe and behave in ways that will serve the ends of the church. You know what they need. You know what they want to hear. You know that saying it for them will produce the results that are important for both themselves and for the church. But to say it because they need to hear it, or because it will help the church to prosper, is to violate in the most fundamental ways the integrity of the fundamental experience upon which the message is allegedly based. It is to be dishonest and inaccurate about what the experience is. It is to contrive it and invent it, not to respond to actual lived experience. It is to stifle the skeptical element of real experience and to rigidify it into creed-like forms to be swallowed without feeling or thought. It is to commit the most profound ethical wrong to oneself and to the hearers of one's message. Do not lie or fabricate experience, Edwards warns, however noble the ends you seek to accomplish in your commitment to the church may be. Avoid at all costs prophecy from institutional goals. I think that's the message. Now, of course, this may be terribly difficult to do, especially when you see that your community is suffering its own despair and confusion, when it searches for meaning and living and finds none. For it is precisely to these needs that the church leader is called to respond. Or at least we assume that the church leader is called to respond to these needs. But Edward's discussion raises the much more general issue of the role of church leaders altogether. Just exactly what are they supposed to do? Is what they are supposed to do purely managerial? Then they must leave their own experience out of it. For to do otherwise is to distort the experience and deceive the people. Is it, on the other hand, to inspire the lost, the searching, the people who are on their way with the truths of their own experience? Then these leaders must sacrifice commitment to institutional goals, to the protection and promotion of the church, because the prophetic insight they bring may lead them in very different ways. Unless a person is uncommonly restrained and cautious, both in articulating his or her experience and in pursuing institutional ends, it will prove impossible to do both. Edward seems to suggest that this problem is characteristic of the Mormon Church. Indeed it is, though I think it's a problem that confronts many other churches as well, and possibly confronts all organized institutional religious groups. But there's a quite specific context within Mormonism in which this problem becomes most acute. Mormonism, unlike most Protestant, Catholic, and other Christian-based groups, incorporates direct appeal to individual religious experience into its institutional procedures. This is evident from the highest officials down. Decision-making, and with it policy construction, rulemaking, the resolution of cases within the church court system, all rest on appeal in prayer to direct religious experience. At least, that is the prevailing assumption. But if Edwards is right, this practice risks corruption with every case, since the individual, the prophet manager, we may call him, the person who wears two hats, whose problems arise from this divided task, that is, the prophet manager, the church official or leader, will be continually tempted to interpret the experience to fit the case at hand. This may not seem to be inventing or contriving experience to conform to the world. One of the things on the list of ways in which to jeopardize the ethical standing of the prophecy. But the risk is clearly there in any case in which religious experience is solicited in order to resolve a practical administrative or judicial problem. Furthermore, skepticism with respect to religious experience, crucial to avoiding what we called animal drama, is threatened with every employment of this experience as authoritative, particularly when it is to govern the beliefs and behavior of people other than the person who had the experience, him or herself. The resolution of disputes, both in administrative and judicial settings, does not easily allow room for this kind of loyal challenge of religious experience. Finally, the risks of allowing individual religious experience, whether one's own or that of some earlier figure within a religious tradition, to degenerate into creed, into heritage, and into professional ritual are alarmingly large, particularly in a tradition in which this experience is accorded such a substantial role. This is not to say that individual religious experience is not important within a church. That is, after all, a very large part of the foundation of religion, but that the perils of using it in the management of an institutional church are very great indeed. Thank you. Did I get it right? I'm told there is a little time for questions, a very little time. And I think the first question might be for me, namely, Mr. Edwards, did I get it right? It's quite an interesting problem. Are there questions? Yeah. My guess would be that you've just asked the most important question, and the answer is it's the hardest one to answer. That is, that's something that the prophet, in this sense, wrestles with continuously, and to which he or she never expects an easy solution. The question is addressed to you, I think, really. So, would you like to answer?
Well, I'd
I think the question that I understand Mel asking, and I knew Mel would ask it, is whether or not it's possible to really ever address these prophetic issues in the language that we have to use. You know, can you just correct that if the language does tie us down as we say it does, then how can you ever talk? I think the risk of a cop-out, I think the only way I would know to do that, if I knew a better way, I think I would be the prophet. And I'm not. I think we're talking about it in the same sense we're talking about classic. What makes a classic as against the contemporary work of literature? What makes a classic is that it speaks to the time in which it is written, and that time is every time. It speaks to every generation of people under every circumstance. It is forever new, no matter how old it gets. And I think that's why our business, and our church, the business of canonizing Scripture 20 minutes after we get it, is asinine. I didn't say it. I mean, you know, and we do this. We don't wait and see if what's said really reflects the human need of experience with the divine in anything more than that moment. And when that begins to be the same need responded to in the same fashion, moment after moment after moment, in life after life after life, then you're talking about, I think, what the role of God is. I think it's basically unimportant. I thought I ought to do that. Well, I think obviously you wouldn't ask the question if you didn't anticipate the answer. Very little. God has very little to do it. The question is not God speaking to prophets. It's prophets living in the presence of whatever we deal with and call God, so that they can speak for Him. And again, I don't buy this. I awaken at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, I awaken at 3 o'clock in the morning, and many things happen to me, none of which I would call prophecy.
Is it sort of
Speaking
of symposium? There we go.
Well, we need to get out. They're coming in,
right.
I guess.
Thank you.